The most successful athletes in any sport have coaches. Whether strength training, running, swinging a bat, or shooting a basket, coaches provide insights and knowledge and pave the way to success. In business, even successful entrepreneurs have coaches. A business coach can help them see the blind spots, fill in the knowledge gaps, or serve as a compass to make sure they're heading in the right direction. In this episode, we'll hear from Eric Edelman, founder of Bigger Cup Consulting, about his experience in working with entrepreneurs to overcome common challenges in hiring the right people, scaling a business, growing revenues, staying focused, and working on soft skills that lead to success. Eric's journey from his early entrepreneurial ventures to founding Bigger Cup Consulting is a testament to his astute business acumen and entrepreneurial spirit. His experience in executive recruiting provided him with a unique perspective on the inner workings of companies, particularly startups in the digital media and technology space. Eric's entrepreneurial journey exemplifies the power of leveraging experience, intuition, and a proactive approach to create opportunities and drive success in the ever-evolving business landscape. Eric, welcome to our podcast series.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
To kick things off, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself that led you on a journey to create Bigger Cup Consulting?
Sure. Where should I start, I guess? I would tell you that I'm a lifelong entrepreneur, and you know, I was that kid in school who was always buying and selling something out of his locker, you know, always starting businesses from a young age. Sold at flea markets when I was in high school. I was the type of kid that got a job that paid real money where I could actually sell something early on. And I founded my first company at 25, and that was a recruiting firm. And I did that for 11 and a half years, founded it with a partner, built it from scratch to 40 employees, $7.5 million in annual revenue. And I sold my share to my partner after 11 and a half years. And I started my business coaching practice relatively soon after that, which we can get into.
That company, and one of the things that you and I have spoken about and that I read on your website, was a company called Three Pillars Recruiting. And you had an interesting focus. A lot of your clients were actually tech startups.
Yeah, and we did almost all of our work with digital media and online ad tech startups. And most of those were companies that were 20 to 400 employees that were post Series A or Series B money and looking to get really big really quickly, get bought by Google or Facebook or do an acquisition or get acquired by them, do an IPO. Their goal was really to scale really quickly, and that's where we came in. So we focused mainly on the non-tech roles within ad tech companies. So sales, marketing, business development, product, sales engineering, operations, those types of roles, which were, you know, pretty evergreen types of positions for them. They always needed talent and became pretty well known in the industry. 40 people is not a big company as far as companies goes, but for recruiting firms, that's large as you really see for the types of companies we were dealing with. And it was a lot of fun dealing with startups because you really get to know the personalities of the founders, the people at the top, and you get a window into how companies function and how they don't function through the hiring process.
Yeah, it was interesting because one of the things that you talked about was that a unique opportunity to look under the hood, right? To see how these things, these companies were working. And based on your experience, when it comes to hiring, what do most companies get right? And what are the common mistakes companies make?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I think that most companies get right, you know, when they're able to understand what the actual problem is they're trying to solve, like on a very tactical level. Right? We have a hole on the product team. We need to hire a product guy. That's like very basic. What I think most companies get wrong is the long-term planning aspect of it, so that you frankly have the ability to hire from a place of calmness and from a place of wanting to find the right person, as opposed to we're in an emergency here. And what companies get wrong, I think, is a lot of the long-term planning aspect of it. How do we want to grow the team? You know, let's say, you know, the rest of this calendar year, if everything goes right or if everything doesn't go right, what's the actual hiring plan? Startups especially really skip over that step a lot of the time, and they end up thinking just, okay, we need a person right now. And then that's when they don't end up making the best hire. A lot of the time, I would say that companies make another mistake where they'll rush through the hiring process really, really quickly. And if they get distracted by a shiny object of a person who can do the job right now without really seeing how that person's going to fit holistically with the rest of the team. I think that's another thing that we saw over the course of many years.
Yeah. So when you say fit holistically, that would be like fitting in with the culture and being part of a team. Because oftentimes, you know, new employees, you want to hire that right person that meshes with your existing team and aligns with your philosophy and the values of the company, right?
Yeah, and sometimes they'll just hire for skill. Just hiring for skill might get you out of the jam that you're in right now, but it doesn't build towards something long term, right?
Right.
That, I think, is when companies are under pressure, they make that poor hiring decision of just hiring for the skill. They kind of get about how is this person with the rest of the team.
Got it. There was a quote on your website. It talked about, and this is when you were growing your business, you showed them how to harness strengths they never knew they had and taught them how to grow their careers in ways they never thought possible. So you're more than just an employer, like a mentoring role, because by making your employees successful, then that raises the value of your organization.
Yeah, and that was about three pillars of recruiting, and that really was what led to our success, frankly. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, it evolved over time. Like I said, I was pretty young when I started the company, so I can't tell you that that was my vision when I set out on that journey. But over time, what I realized was the entire enterprise value of any recruiting organization is focused around its people. There was very little value to the database, even though we had a database of well over 100,000 people. That wasn't really, you know, that wouldn't have been very valuable to sell. What really was valuable were the team members that were working day in, day out. And we got there through being able to spot talent and people who had a lot of potential. And we hired a lot of people with very little work experience, maybe their first or second job out of school, but who already came kind of pre-motivated. I liked hiring people who already had families, who were already in need of actual money, not just like $30,000 a year. That wasn't enough for them. You can't teach motivation. They came pre-motivated. What they needed was a soft landing pad where they could take their raw skills, they could build on them, and they could really learn to manage and grow a team under our umbrella. They can learn how to deal with client relationships. They can learn how to have powerful conversations with candidates every single day and build on those skills. And teaching people that, it wasn't a course. That was just the ethos of the company. That was the most powerful thing that we did, and that was really why we had whatever success that we did have.
We focused so far in our conversation on the employer and business side, but let's talk about someone who's developing their own career. One of the things and the feedback that I get is the difficulty out there to navigate the digital environment, the online recruiting environment. What kind of advice would you have for those candidates out there that are trying to navigate the new online environment and, quite frankly, the advent of AI's involvement in recruiting?
Sure. First of all, I started recruiting in 2006. And at that time, somebody, you know, people are already telling you, why are you getting into this? You know, LinkedIn's going to replace recruiting firms. And LinkedIn has certainly impacted how the recruitment process works in a huge way. But it didn't replace recruiting firms, and I don't think that AI is going to replace recruiting firms either. It's going to impact the way that people get jobs, but it's not going to replace the interview process or anything like that. Hmm. If somebody's looking for a new job, it almost doesn't matter who you are, but it's certainly true in tech. The number one place to start is with people who already know you, people who know your name, people who already have your number in their phone. Those are the people who are most likely to connect you with your next job. That's number one. I think that's going to be true for the foreseeable future. People forget that step of the process, that the most likely person to hire you is somebody who already knows you or is referred to you directly by somebody who knows you. That's the biggest piece of advice I can give anybody looking for a new job. People think that they have to spend a lot of time on LinkedIn making content and videos and doing all sorts of things for their social presence or taking courses. All of that stuff is great, but it's very unlikely to actually land you a job today. Thinking about who knows you and who can refer you to the right person. And it doesn't even need to be somebody who knows you professionally. Frankly, it could be your mother's best friend who works for a company that you want to work for.
Right.
That's the most powerful thing you can do to get yourself a job. In terms of how technology is going to impact the recruitment process, I think it makes it much easier to make good candidates apparent to employers and to make good employers apparent to candidates. I think just like LinkedIn made it easier than, you know, if you were looking at, I don't know, newspapers to find a job. It made the connections more visible. And I think AI is going to continue that process. But at the end of the day, people are going to work with people, not technology. So at some point, it's going to get, after you get through the sourcing process, there's going to be a conversation with somebody at your new employer. And I don't think that's going to be replaced by technology.
Right. Again, that's terrific advice. People sort of ignore the basics of finding that job because they believe that they just send out enough resumes and respond to enough ads, they'll find that position.
Just to, maybe I'll just elaborate that a little bit, because I find that, you know, if there's anything that I can do to help somebody get a job, like I don't want to miss that point. The black hole of sending your resume out, of applying online, is really, really soul crushing for everybody. Everybody from entry level to people making $500,000 a year. And it's great, and it's an appropriate thing to do, but it's not likely you're going to get like a 2-5% reply rate, something like that. So just keep that in mind if you're going through that process. It seems like there's an allure of you're doing something. You are, but you're not doing as much as you think you are, because usually the resume is not even getting read by a person on the other end. The personal relationships that you have that you can harness to get yourself a new job are much more important than that.
Got it. Thank you. Let's sort of turn this around a little bit too. So you've taken your personal experience from your initial business that you started. You had a unique opportunity and a unique position to view how startups and how businesses grow. And then you brought that expertise into your new business. Could you tell us a little bit about the business you run today?
Yeah, so now I work full-time as a business coach. I work mainly with founders and entrepreneurs. You know, I try to work with what I know. Any coach in any area that you're working with, they should be a guide for you, and they should have been to the place that you're trying to get to with their help. So I work with founders and entrepreneurs, 10 to 100 person companies, usually $1 to $10 million in revenue. And that's the area that I know. And I've seen all of the challenges that an entrepreneur in that stage is going through. And I kind of got to this place, like I said, it started with a recruiting firm where we're really coaching our employees to do better and to grow themselves and their business under our umbrella. And after I sold that, I had a friend who volunteered for the Jewish Entrepreneur, which is a charity organization that just matches up mentors. You don't have to be Jewish to utilize it. And he had been calling me for a couple years already, asking me to be a mentor and a coach for them. And I'd always said I was too busy. And once I sold, so I didn't have that excuse anymore. And I started working with a young entrepreneur that they matched me up with, who was a new CEO who was taking over a family business. And he just needed help. And we worked together. I did that pro bono for 3 years. We met every week for quite a long time. That was how I got into coaching. And, you know, I realized that this is an area that I know and where I have something to offer. And working one-on-one with entrepreneurs is amazing. And usually I'm helping them try to get themselves from a position of being a founder into being a true CEO, which is taking their hand out of every bucket, making sure that they're delegating appropriately, really doing some long-term planning and goal setting. And all those kind of things that kind of fall by the wayside when you're trying to run 100 miles an hour and just grow a company really quickly.
It dawned on me that you probably have a little checklist of critical skills you want to see in a leader that you're coaching. What are some of those critical skills that you want them to develop?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, first of all, everybody is different. And that's the value of one-on-one coaching versus reading amazing books or watching great videos online. I think that there certainly are some standard things that every single founder needs to do if they want to be able to scale their company. Number one, these are in no particular order. They need to be able to plan long-term and fix the airplane while they're flying it, because there's not going to be a time where they can just shut down their business for a few months, really get everything in order and then start. Never works like that. They need to be able to do a lot of different things at once and keep the day-to-day running while keeping their eye on the target for the future. That's a critical skill to be able to do. And it takes practice to just be able to actually be in it for the long-term thinking while you're dealing with the short-term stuff. That's critically important. Number two is delegating. I happen to like this book, Buy Back Your Time by Dan Martell. It's a really quick, easy read, and it gives you just a really good framework of how to delegate effectively, how to figure out what you're delegating, how to hand it off appropriately, and most importantly, how to check in with the person you're delegating to in order to make sure that the task are actually going to get done. That I find founders are really at their core, usually not initially skilled at intuitively. They usually need help with that. And if they haven't done it before, it's not rocket science, but it's something that they need to work through. Number three, I would say that they usually need help with time management. Almost everybody I know, whether they're an executive or not, struggles with time management. And being able to triage and prioritize different issues that come your way on an hourly basis, on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, these are all things that are, you know, those are different buckets, and it's crucial to be able to figure out how you're going to triage. And successful people don't get done everything they plan to do that day, that week, or that month. Successful people decide proactively what they're not going to do. And to be able to have the freedom to say, even though this is a great project, I'm just not going to work on this right now. I'm going to push this off entirely, or I'm going to delete it from my to-do list. That's an empowering and freeing feeling that takes you out of the drudgery of, I have so many things to do, how am I going to get all this done?
Right. And then you want to have that ability to say no to those things that really just get in the way of being a success. And I noted that one of the things that you had posted, I think it was on LinkedIn, you talked about setting aside an hour a week. It almost sounded like reflective time. Think about what's happening, what's working, what's not. Was that sort of the message there?
Yeah, you have to block off the time, because I think that since there are an unlimited amount of tasks that somebody can do, they don't have free time. I think it's really important to specifically block off time when you're only engaging in thinking about, like, you could be sitting in just a room with no computer, no phone, piece of paper and a pen, whatever works best for you. But some time when you're blocked off from all the other activities and just thinking of how can I strategically grow the business? If you don't block off the time to do it, you won't ever have time to do it. That's a great thing that I always, I do that myself. And I think that it's important for every entrepreneur and founder to do.
I focused on, it was interesting that I saw that you actually acquired a business. I think it was called First Avenue Manufacturing, and it was a turnaround situation. What was the allure of getting involved in a turnaround?
Sure. And I skipped over that part in the journey. So after Three Pillars, you know, I was thinking about, okay, what am I going to do? I had a financial cushion and I didn't have an emergency that I needed to work immediately. And, you know, I took a little bit of time off, but I'm not the type that wants to just sit and rest for a year. So I said, okay, I'd love to skip the startup phase of the next business venture. I was under 40 still. I'm not ready to retire and I'd love to revive something. So I spent a lot of time on biz buy sell and meeting with business brokers, proactively looking for a business to buy. Mm-hmm. You know, I had certain criteria that, you know, I didn't want to own my laundry. I didn't want to own a restaurant, certain industries that I didn't like and approximate purchase price range. And I really didn't want to buy a big operating business with a large number of employees because I just didn't know, you know, how am I ever going to know if everybody's going to walk out day one? So I couldn't get my head around that.
Right.
I wanted a small business that was just the beating heart and brain of the company only. And I found that in this small manufacturing business, which manufactured bed linens in Thompson, Georgia, which is a tiny, small town, a rural Main Street America, literally off of Main Street. And this company had been around since the 70s. It had been over 100 employees in the early 80s before all the manufacturing went overseas. It had gradually atrophied through a couple different owners. There were just four employees when I bought it. And it was a very small business. About $300,000 in revenue, very nascent online presence. And the goal was to take it from a company that was a manufacturing company that happened to sell a few things on its own website and on Amazon to an e-commerce company that happened to control the manufacturing. That was the plan. I'll tell you, any entrepreneur that doesn't have a couple failures on their resume as being too safe, and this was one of my failures in terms of, you know, from a business perspective, it's strict dollars and cents. I put like my heart and soul and tons of time and effort and energy into it. And it just did not work. I could not, we were able to grow sales online, you know, a huge amount. Our Amazon sales went from about 30K when I bought it. By the time we were winding things down, it was around 350, 400K. So it wasn't as though there were no successes. That's pretty nice growth, but I wasn't able to take it to, you know, a $10 million company type of thing. And I didn't see the path towards that. There are a lot of challenges in manufacturing a product profitably here in the United States of America.
And I appreciate you sharing that story because there are critical lessons that come out of failures. And certainly what we need to be is wise enough to learn from those things and then take them. And what would you look at the next business and what would you do differently? Or maybe just it would change your outlook for acquiring that next business. So you're sitting down now with a group of young entrepreneurs and they come to you and they say, given all of your experience, what's some of the key advice that you would have for an aspiring entrepreneur?
That's a great question. I would say you have to figure out what you're best at doing, and that's what you want to build your company around. For example, I'm a good sales guy, and recruiting is really a sales job. That's a core focus of any business that I'm going to run. Part of the reason why I made a mistake with First Avenue Manufacturing is that the core of that business was really not sales. It was operations and manufacturing. Like, I didn't know that well enough. Whereas in business coaching, every single entrepreneur that I'm working with is looking to grow sales. They certainly should be. So if you're an entrepreneur and you're trying to figure out what type of business to found, what you want to do, you have to first focus everything around finding a business that harnesses your skills as best possible. That has to be at the core of the offering.
And beyond that, in terms of, okay, so you find that business, you've got that concept and idea. I would think that you're going to also want to have a group around you, advisors, a sounding board, to make sure that you're looking at every different aspect of the business so that you don't get yourself in trouble day one. And then also talk to a little bit about finding startup capital.
Sure. So in terms of surrounding yourself with the right people, if you can hire people that are lieutenants, that are close to your equal, that are true sounding boards, whose opinion you really value from the point of validity, they've earned the right to that with their skill and ability. That's the best. If you really have people that you're around day to day, every single day that you trust, that's number one. Number two is finding some kind of professional organization where you can interface with other entrepreneurs, even if they're in different industries. If you're in an industry where there's a trade group of some kind, where you sit down and meet monthly, whether it's virtual or in person, that's even better. It's lonely at the top, and you have to develop a healthy sense of ways to motivate yourself and feeling that you're not alone in this entrepreneurial venture, and also ways to gather new intel from other people that are doing the same types of things that you're doing. In terms of raising capital, you know, I will be the first to admit, I've never raised a dime of capital. That's not my personal expertise. This is a challenging time to raise venture capital funding in general. People are playing things very cautiously. It's a sales gig. You know, in general, I've talked to tons of people who have successfully raised capital. And the one thing they all have in common is that they're not afraid to pick up the phone and just start reaching out to people who they think could give them money, whether it's friends and family, whether it's VCs, whether it's family offices. People answer cold LinkedIn messages all the time for people looking to raise capital. So I think that there's a thought process out there that there's a way to do this, and I don't know what that is. And if only I could, then I would have all this money. Instead, I think the best way to think about it is, who could give me money that would be interested in this story, and just reach out to them. And perhaps that's my sales mentality in general. That's what I've seen work for people that I know and interacted with.
I think that's spot on. I mean, as a person that was a business, my partners and I, for 35 years, and from time to time, whether it was through a private equity firm or through, let's go to our bank and convincing them that it's good business to lend us money. So I think you're right. Just think about in terms of how you would sell the value of your product to someone. Talk about that as your company and selling the value of your business to someone. I think that's great advice. Eric, what's the one word that describes who you are?
I would say ambitious. You know, I try to always be reaching for the next thing and reaching just one step past where I am. I would describe a lot of entrepreneurs that way. That's really what makes a great entrepreneur. They're not satisfied with how things are today, even if they're very good. They can be happy with how things are today, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be completely satisfied with it. I try to be ambitious about where I'm trying to go and go somewhere that I maybe wouldn't have dreamed of 5 or 10 years ago.
I think that's great. And based on hearing your story, ambitious is certainly a great word that describes who you are. Eric, thank you so much for sharing your story and your just incredible insights. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you to Dr. Deborah Cohen for putting us in touch and inviting me.
Eric and I opened our conversation by discussing what companies get right and what can they do better in the hiring process. Eric recognized that many founders view hiring at the tactical level, generally overlooking its long-term impact. And yes, a short-term view can deliver someone to fill the need, but it fails to take a holistic view of the applicant. He suggests creating a hiring plan that includes questions like, does this person fit within our culture, and will they mesh with the team, and will they become an excellent long-term fit? Eric noted that it's easy to become disheartened when sending applications to online job sites. Be mindful that the reply rate for sending your resume to a job posting site is only 2 to 5%. And yes, it does seem like your resumes are ending in a black hole, and it can be soul-crushing when no one responds. But don't be discouraged. And remember that personal relationships, networking, and referrals will take you further, faster in trying to land a job. As a business coach, Eric described key strengths founders and leaders of startups require but often need help with. First, your time and focus are in short supply, so you need to become ambidextrous. Develop the ability to keep the day-to-day business running while maintaining an eye on the future. Eric used the analogy to fix the airplane while you're flying it. Become agile and resourceful, but never lose sight of the goals you set for the organization. Next, become proficient in delegating. He points out that most founders find it difficult, but with practice, it can become a skill you can master. Eric recommended the book Buy Back Your Time by Dan Martell as a guide for those struggling with delegating. Of course, time management skills are essential. The ability to triage and prioritize different issues can be mastered. He observed that successful people define what they expect to accomplish and proactively decide what they will not work on. It is the power to say no to those things that get in the way of being a success. He mentioned that there's a need to block off time for reflection and think about how you can strategically grow your business. Many leaders fail to schedule time for this process and allow their days to become saturated with issues needing a quick fix. At the same time, the vision, mission, and strategies are left unattended. And last, learn from your failures. Even Eric described his experience investing in a turnaround that did not achieve his financial goals. I also asked Eric about key advice he has for aspiring entrepreneurs, and he made four key points. First, figure out what you do best, and that's what you want to build your business around. Second, hire people who are close to your equals, who are true sounding boards, whose opinions you value, and who have the right skills and abilities to complement your strengths. Third, find some professional organization where you can interface with other entrepreneurs, even if they're in different industries. From his experience, you can gather new intel from other people doing the same things you're doing and confronting similar problems in trying to grow your business. It will motivate you and make you feel you're not alone in this entrepreneurial journey. Lastly, the one thing people who have successfully raised capital all have in common is that they're not afraid to pick up the phone and start reaching out to those people who they think can invest, whether it's friends and family, venture capital, or other potential sources. Just get started. And the one word that Eric used to describe himself is ambitious. It is a word he'd use to describe most entrepreneurs. Ambition is a strong desire for success and achievement, and the willingness to put in an extraordinary effort to reach it. We thank Eric for sharing his experiences and valuable insights. This podcast is executive produced by John Rebecki and New York Institute of Technology in conjunction with the School of Management and the Office of Strategic Communications and External Affairs. The interim dean of the School of Management and executive producer of this podcast is Deborah Cohen. Our marketing and social media strategist is Petra Shantaraga, and our audio editor and mixer is Brian Falk from Abacus Entertainment. Special thanks to Professor Ellie Schwartz and Victoria Greco for all their support. Until next time.